Good evening, church. I just got to walk over here and do something real quick. I seen this during the song service. Oh, it must be. I was hoping it was like one of those things, a German roasted almonds, but it's not. Because if so, I was taking a break. But anyway, all right. That way I don't have to think about that now the rest of the sermon. Because if not, I'd have been keep looking back over there. But anyway, thank you for coming out tonight. We've got our continuing our Revelation series. We're up to chapter 6. And so we know next week we've got the Singspiration. And so if you got something for that, sign up for that. But so I'm just letting you know we will not get through chapter 6 tonight. So we'll have some time to chew on that a little bit, and then in the 1st of November get going on that again. But anyway, Revelation chapter 6, we've entitled this chapter, The Book is Opened. The Book is Open. Remember the last two chapters, we've been looking through heaven, trying to find on heaven, earth, under the earth, trying to find somebody worthy enough to open up the book. And we found out as we finished the week prior to our revival that it was a slain lamb that is able to open the book. And our slain lamb is Jesus Christ. We'll see the lamb here with, or the book is open. Much of Romans, you can tell where I was at this past weekend. A Revelation is done with scare tactics, as we see, and we'll share a little bit about that here. But and making us feel like, you know, it cannot be understood, that it's all beyond us. And in a certain way, doesn't that kind of remind us of the way the Roman Catholic Church operated? You know, we don't want to give you the Bible because you won't be able to figure it out. Let's look into God's Word. How am I? Oh, that was supposed to be moving. Give it a click, Bob, and see if that happens to move. No, something must be lost in the translation from PowerPoint to whatever. So, all right. Anyway, imagine. So we got a white horse, a black horse, ashen horse, the red horse. I don't want to forget about that one. But anyway, it was just a really cool picture because it transitioned through all of those and the different riders that would be upon them. But anyway, so let's get going. The Lamb breaking the seals. The Lamb breaking the seals. We'll find this in Revelation 6:1, which we'll get to in just a moment. So we're in the time of about 96 AD. Just a reminder to you. And we'll continue to notice this as the world's events unfold. These events will show the plan of God through the ages. This chapter contains what many like to refer to as the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? Or the four horsemen of Revelation. Really, it's just the scare tactics of the premillennialists that make this captivating to the casual Bible reader or student. And I'm thankful that we here try to be more than that, so we see things differently than what the world sees. Remember, this book is a book of symbols. If we do not start off correctly, then we can't finish correctly. Once again, a world history book can show us these things have already taken place. Just like John was told at the beginning of this book, these things will shortly take place. Revelation 6:1. Then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals. And I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a loud voice of thunder, "Come." One thing I want to share, and as we get through, continue to go through the book of Revelation, I think one of the things that makes it a little harder and difficult to follow is very rarely do we go through and we just see like the seven seals. So he'll do six of them, and then he stops and takes like a pause or intermission, and then discusses something else, and then comes back to the seventh seal because he wants you to understand again. I think it's like as we see the book of Acts, as I've said before, I understand the book of Acts a whole lot better when I take Romans through the end of at least the Paul's letters and slide those into the right categories and where they go. It makes it easier for us to understand. And I think that's what they do in the book of Revelation as well. So instead of just going right straight through it, they'll go and then something else. They want to explain this, what's going on, so that when we get to this next one, because you'll see there'll be a chapter, two chapters, three chapters, that we may skip over something, and then all of a sudden when we get to that, you'll be like, oh, I thought we already discussed that. Well, we didn't finish it. And so that's what I want to share for us, or just for you to continue to think about. John was told to come and see, and this is what he saw. God's warning of a coming judgment. The voice was strong and loud. Once again, a command is given, come. So guess what he did, right? He did. He went ahead and come. The first seal here then we see, this is the white horse. Not a mistyping. It's not the White House, okay? But it's the white horse. In chapter 6 and verse 2, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But the years after the writing of Revelation were wonderful years for the Roman Empire. Boy, I got some serious sinus drainage tonight. Sorry. I can either take a drink or do it the other way. Thanks. Anyway, and so this is what we want to continue to remember, is that this is showing, remember all the prayers of the saints? And we'd been talking about that, and we'll continue to talk about that. And we say it's a reminder for us today that do we want for our government to change? Then pray for it. The only thing, the reminder is that the government might not change while we're alive. This is sometimes things that happen far out. And so what we pray is that for our children or our grandchildren or our great-grandchildren or whatever, that hopefully they'll have things better than we did. And if there were struggles and things going on in the country, this is the same way with the Roman government. The Roman government now is at the height of their play during the course of their reign. It were wonderful years for the empire. The timeline of history that will begin with its 96 in with, let me start over. The timeline of history that we will begin with is in 96 AD, as we made mention. This is what is known as the Nerva Empire, or Nerva, excuse me, is the emperor, the new line of Caesars. He was emperor until 98 AD. The first five emperors of the Nerva Antonian dynasty, for example, are typically known as the five good emperors. He was from Crete, where the bow was its main instrument of war. Under Trajan, a later emperor in Nerva's line, Rome had its greatest extent of influence. This line of Caesars continued through 192 AD and finished with maybe somebody you know from gladiator fame, Commodus. Commodus was the son of Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was the was that first emperor that you might remember in the movie Gladiator. the old man that passed away at the beginning. And Commodus and his wickedness led to his assassination and the end of the line of the good emperors in 192 AD. So Commodus was that kind of a transition from the five good emperors to, and we saw what kind of a, my wife cannot stand that movie just because of Commodus. Anyway, so Revelation 6:2. I looked and behold a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. One misconception is we've got to remember, so who's opening the seals? The worthy lamb, the worthy slain lamb is opening the seals. He breaks the first seal and they see a white horse on it and someone on there is carrying a bow. Right away, we see the white horse. Let's back up. Right away, the religious world sees the white horse, and so who do they automatically assume is on it? Jesus. Jesus was the one that opened the seals. Jesus isn't the one on the horse. Jesus comes with a sword of fire from his mouth, two-edged sword. This conqueror comes with a what? With a bow in his hand. This is letting us know, check out world history, see what we've been talking about, and don't let, as we said, scare tactics make us see something that's not there. Although a white horse does carry with it the thought of victory, this is not Christ. Christ carries a two-edged sword, not a bow. The rider is never called by any of the names that refer to Christ. Christ is the breaker of the seals, not one of the horsemen. Why would the first horseman be spiritual and the last three be physical, if we're going to look at it that way? The rider just represents one that is a conqueror and is conquering as Rome is doing at this time. The horse represents a time of war. The meaning of this time frame in history is one of victory, of conquest, and of rulership. Yes, it's of Rome, but remember what the saints have been praying for. Because Rome wasn't, that first century, Rome wasn't overly nice to the Christians. And so this is the second century now. They may have what they call good emperors, but they have still not yet, they are still trying to pursue Rome's benefits and not the Lord's. The Roman Empire was at its perhaps its most prosperous and triumphant time. These were their happy days. Gibbons, and we'll refer a lot to him over the next several lessons, but Gibbons calls this Rome's golden age. Warm Rome. Rome wore garlands of victory on their head, and their territory was larger than it ever had been before. This is what the white horse stood for. The second seal is the red horse. We'll see this in verses 3 and 4. After the glorious years of the Nerva Antonines era, a 92-year civil war broke out in Rome. Over 50 emperors and pretenders rose and fell. The Praetorian Guard, whose symbol was a great sword, caused the civil war when they sold out the empire. Revelation 6, 3 through 4. When he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, "Come," and another, a red horse, went out. And to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to them. The sign of the red horse was to be a sign of bloodshed, of war, and of carnage. After Commodus was assassinated in 192 AD, this began the third and the most calamitous period. Therefore, taking peace from the earth. They always took peace by slaying, by slaughtering, or sacrificing one another in civil war. Not a war from without, but a war from within. And if any of us in recent past history understand the damage that civil war causes, This is an example of that. This time lasted another 92 years, from 192 to 284. During this time, there were 32 emperors and 27 pretenders hurling themselves back and forth off the throne by continual civil warfare. As it usually goes, a good way to look at it is, they say it's a civil war, but really it's a not-so-civil war. 92 years of incessant civil warfare taught the world on what a frail foundation the virtue of the Antonines had placed their felicity on, of the empire. We find that in that's a quote from Sismondi's Fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbons, in his book, The Decline and the Fall of the Roman Empire, says, "Such were the barbarians and such were the tyrants who, under the reign of Valerian and Gallienus, dismembered the province and reduced the empire to the lowest pitch of disgrace and ruin, from whence it seemed impossible that it should ever emerge." So let's also take a look at the great sword mentioned in this text. The great sword, or a long sword, when it says a great sword, it's not referring to a small handheld dagger. It's referring to a big, long sword. The great sword, or a long sword, was used as the sword of government, to be used in the matters of justice and executing righteousness. I hope that when we think of that, we are reminded of Paul's letter to the Romans in Romans 13:4. "For our government," he says, "it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do not, but if you do what is evil, be afraid of it, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil." And again, then, this is when government is run by people that are trying to at least accomplish some sort of morality and godliness of some sort in their decision-making. Not if you have wicked leaders, then there's going to be wicked rules. The sword that the Romans and the Praetorian Guards would use were those that were short for close-quarter battles. The long sword, as we said, represents judgment. The type used in combat for fights of close encounters was that short sword. Also, the short sword contrasted the great sword of the text. The Praetorian Guard had used the short sword to get what they wanted, but God is saying that judgment will get what it needs. The short sword also defined the length of each of their reigns, being that they had over 50 emperors in a 92-year span. That is very, very short reigns for the most part. That's the red horse. The third seal, then, is that of the black horse, which we'll read about here in verses 5 and 6. The 92-year civil war took its toll on the empire and those around it. The continued warring led to a time of shortages, as we know wartime can do. Food was found to be selling at 8 times the normal price. And we think since gas doubled, we got a problem, right? 8 times the normal price. Eggs haven't even doubled, or haven't went 8 times the normal price, but they have increased. The luxuries of life, such as oil and wine, were in short supply. Revelation 6, 5 and 6. "When he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come!' And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hands. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine.'" As we made reference to, famines are a thing that comes along with wartime. It's a result of war. With a white horse meaning victory, the black horse means poverty. The scales are used to weigh out exactly what is precious and rare. Food was scarce, so it was sold by weight. Remember in the book of Daniel, when the scales were taken out and they were found wanting. If the scales were taken out to measure America, would we see much of plenty for what the Lord desires for us, or would we be found wanting? Other passages, minor prophets, talk about a famine for the word. When we talk about famines, we just don't talk about food being a problem. We talk about spirituality being a problem, and the word of God not being presented as it should being a problem, and it's weighed out on the scales and we are found wanting. Leviticus 26:26. When I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts so that you will eat and not be satisfied. In other words, it's going to be a time of struggle. Ezekiel 4:16 through 17. Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, behold, I'm going to break the staff of bread in Jerusalem, and they will eat bread by weight and with anxiety. See, eating's supposed to bring us a peace and a pleasure. But when you eat and you're considering that it may be your last meal, it changes your thoughts. Await and with anxiety, and drink water by measure and in horror. So imagine you're rationed your water. You know, we have bottles of water we drink or whatever, and we may have that much that's been left in there for the day, and we just swirl around and dump it out. What is reminding us is that these times are rough and these times are tough, and clean water for drinking, hard to come by. Verse 17, because bread and water will be scarce, and they will be appalled with one another and waste away in their iniquity. The denarius in Roman coinage, a denarius was a day's pay for food. Matthew 20, verse 2 says, and when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius for the day, he sent them into his vineyard. It was a day's wage of work. And so you go back and you look at this, and we see how much it was being sold for and what you were getting for a denarius. Very little. The wheat is 12 times the normal cost. The measure of wheat is one quart. Wheat and barley were very scarce. And after war, there is also economic hardship. The luxury items of oil and wine and food were maybe available to the extremely wealthy, while the poor could not even afford wheat or barley. And barley was one of those very poor food items. If you're a college student living on your own, it'd be a lot compared to ramen noodles, right? Very cheap, not very tasty. Once again, Gibbons in his book, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, says, at this time, even the wealthiest families were ruined by partial fines and confiscations, and the great body of subjects were oppressed by ingenious and aggravated taxes. Can you imagine that? Emperor Caracalla was greedier than most other Caesars before him. Instead of taxing 1/20th of all the legacy taxations and inheritance, he decided to up it to 1/10. During his reign, he crushed every part of the empire under the weight of his iron scepter. Lactantius, a Christian author in the 3rd and 4th centuries, said of these times, swarms of exactors sent in to the provinces and cities filled them with agitation and terror, as though a conquering enemy were leading them into captivity. And this was all from within their own government. The fields were separately measured, the trees and the vines and the flocks and the herds numbered, and an examination made of the people in the cities that cultivated in the cities. It cultivated a cultivated and rude were united as of the same rank. The streets were crowded with groups of families, and everyone required to appear with his children and slaves. Tortures and lashes resounded on every side. And so what does this do to help the food market? Right? Tell your family to come out, all your slaves, and we're going to whip you. That makes everybody feel better about the government, don't it? And so what it's trying to do is to keep them in check and to keep them in line for the hierarchy's benefit. Tortures and lashes resounded on every side. Sons were gibbeted in the presence of their parents, and the most confidential servants harassed that they might make disclosures against their masters, and wives that they that they might testify unfavorably of their husbands. So they might try to get the wife and kids to lie about the father so they can take the father off to prison or execute him or whatever. And then so who would get all of the belongings to that family then? Not the wife and the children. If there were a total destitution of property, they would still be tortured to make acknowledgments against themselves, and when overcome by pain, inscribed for what they did not possess. So if you do possess things, then you were to sacrifice that and give it up. If you did not possess things, then you were whipped and possibly killed for that. Neither age nor ill health was admitted as an excuse for not appearing. So it didn't matter how old you were or how sick you were, you had to appear out before the government. The sick and the weak were borne to the place of inscription, a reckoning made of the age of each, and years added to the young and deducted from the old in order to subject them once again to a higher taxation. In other words, so if you had a boy that wasn't old enough to be in the army yet, they said he was older than he was, and they'd take him, put him in the army. You had someone who was older and supposed to be a little more tax-free, they would say they were younger than they were so that they had to pay the taxes. The whole scene was filled with wailing and sadness. In the meantime, individuals died, and the herds and the flocks diminished, and yet tribute none was nonetheless required to be paid for the dead. So that is what was no longer allowed, either to live or to die without taxes. Mendicants alone escaped, where nothing could be wrenched, and whom misfortune and misery had made incapable of further oppression. These the impious wretch affecting to pity, that they might not suffer want, ordered to be assembled, borne off in vessels, and then plunged into the sea. So in other words, they were going to take care of you one way or another. That was the third seal. The fourth seal, this is the ashen horse, not the Asher horse. The ashen horse is yellowish green in color. Might be called the sick horse or the pale horse, depending if you like your tombstone references. What color of a horse this will be. But when there is a lack of nutritious food available, disease seems to climb and health seems to decline. Of course, didn't we see enough of that already with the black horse and poverty? But when health declines, the death will increase. Historian Gibbon estimated that one half of the Roman Empire population died at this time. Death came by fighting, by starvation, by diseases, and even by hungry animals that would roam through the villages and snatch up the weak and the young. Revelation 6, 7, and 8. When the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, "Come." I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. That's the line from Tombstone, if you're not aware. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. The word or color ashen is that of a yellowish green. Have you ever had somebody, being that we're school and we've got kids that come in, there'll be some kid come into the office and they'll just be like, "I don't feel good." And I'm like, "You didn't even have to say anything, because just your color shows us that you are sick, that you don't feel good." And about that time, bleh, right? You just had to prove it, didn't you? So this whole idea is that it is of sick in nature and of color. These riders rode with a sword and brought death, meaning he claimed the old dead green body. Some of you know what that means. While Hades, that followed with him, claimed the soul. Death claims the body. Hades, the abode of the dead, not hell, that is the one mistranslation of that, follows with them and takes the soul. Pestilence is the result of war, famine, and death. They were given authority over a quarter of the earth. Remember, we can only lay claim to the amount of authority that is given to us. We see that all through the parables. We see that through the leadership in the church. We only have what authority has been given to us. With the authority came the power to kill. This killing would take place by the means of the sword, by hunger, by pestilence, and wild beast. Plagues killed many. Beasts after a war were a menace, and wild beasts were used in the arenas as well. And we've seen that in many movies too. The fierce form of death was at its height from 250 AD to 265 AD, a 15-year period. It was common to have famine and calamity. However, to extend the time period lets us know that it was not something normal, but something of a more serious kind. It was the inevitable consequence of the rapine and oppressive, which annihilated, the produce of the present and even destroyed future harvests. Famine is almost always followed up by an epidemical diseases, the effect of scantily and unwholesome foods causes a great problem. Other causes must have contributed to the furious plague. This famine raged in every province, every city, and almost every family in the Roman Empire. It says at some point, the average number of Romans dying per day was 5,000 per day. If towns that escaped the hands of the barbarians still survived, they were then entirely depopulated and decimated by one of these other three means: famine, pestilence, or beasts. And if we go through and we just look at this, again, the church is praying for the destruction of Rome. So over this course of 200 and 300 years, do you think they should have changed their prayer? I don't know. They got what they prayed for Rome to be destroyed. You know, we say we want for America to either, turn. That may mean rougher times for us. It may mean, all sorts of different things. We think that because the enemy is destroyed, that things are going to be great for us. But we got to understand, we live as the farmers in the parables, let the wheat grow with the weeds. There's going to be good that are going to perish. Do you think everybody that just died here in the Roman government were Romans? No, it said those of the Roman Empire. Do you think there were Christians in the Roman Empire? We know there were Christians in the Roman Empire. Do you think they were untouched by pestilence, by beasts, by wars? Certainly not. So what we're saying is, just a reminder, be careful what we pray for. It doesn't hurt to get real specific in our prayers. We can say, Lord, take down this government. We could pray, Lord, may Putin be stripped of his power. But you don't know how the Lord would plan for that to happen, so how that would affect our country. And I would hope not to find out the negative anyway. So those are just the first four horses, or the four horsemen there in Revelation 6, the first four seals. The fifth seal is that of the souls of the slain. We're not going to get into that this evening, but it's a reminder to us that those as Christians, we can pray and make a difference in the world's outcome. What we'll find out in, farther on with the fifth seal is that even those that have been moved on from this world, the Lord listens to those of the souls of the slain as well. And so it's just something for us to consider, especially those that fall at unfortunate times in history. There's a plan of salvation that's given to us. It says we need to believe in Jesus Christ, that we need to repent of our sin, that we confess Jesus Christ as Lord, and that we are immersed into Jesus Christ for that forgiveness of our sin, and that we live faithfully. The thing we see here in Revelation is a reminder to us today that Christians, the Lord does care about, but we still have this life to live. It may be good and great. It may be harsh. But I know this. Whether it's good and great or it's harsh, either one's going to pale in comparison to how wonderful heaven will be one day.